selling the new friendship back in Iran. Today, Monday, September 30th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Presidents Obama and Rouhani have spoken on the phone, but they still have hardliners to contend with in Washington and Tehran. We'll hear how Iranians are reacting to Rouhani's diplomatic overtures and how America's allies in Saudi Arabia are feeling about Obama cozying up to Iran. And later, where have all the monarch butterflies gone? They're facing big challenges on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's been very, very quiet, and it's that silence that really began to alarm me.
Plus, the secret to the fastest long-distance runners on Earth.
You hear stories about people running 2 or 3 miles to school every day, and this running, of course, is done at 8 or 9,000 feet.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Among all the big news stories recently, a few stick out. The fiscal shenanigans in Washington. There's also the diplomatic courtship between the U.S. and Iran, and we'll dive into that story in a second. You've also got to stick around for another story that caught our attention last weekend, the new men's world record for a marathon set in Berlin on Sunday. The winner shaved a few seconds off the old record, and in a few minutes we'll hear just how hard it's going to be to take off another 3 minutes plus to bring the marathon record under the two-hour mark.
It's a little bit like what Nelson Mandela said about being in prison. You know, the day seemed like years and the year seemed like days. So sometimes a minute or two in a marathon or a 10K can be the longest minute or two you'll ever experience.
Okay, so pushing the envelope on what's physically possible takes time. What about changing what's diplomatically possible, as in the U.S. and Iran right now? President Obama seems to be trying. His recent phone chat with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani made big waves here, an apparent sea change after more than 30 years of hostility between Washington and Tehran. Earlier, I asked Jason Rezaian about the reaction in Iran. Jason is the Tehran correspondent for the Washington Post.
Well, I think people are admittedly surprised that the change is happening so quickly, but I think they're also still a little bit reluctant to buy into it wholeheartedly because this enmity has gone on for so long that we still have to wait and see. There's still lots and lots to be done, but obviously the news of the phone call between the two presidents was a big surprise, and I would say by the vast majority of Iranians, a welcome surprise.
Mm. Rouhani came back to Tehran and was greeted by not exactly the welcome wagon at the airport. What happened?
Well, I can't say that I was there, but from folks that I spoke to that were, it sounded like the majority of people there were supporters of his. But you know, there was some hardline, what we call besiege militants there, and I guess they tried to pelt his entourage with eggs, and shook up his car a little bit. It sounded like not the prettiest scene in the world, but we've certainly seen much, much bigger displays of opposition or hardline sentiment here in Iran over the past few years.
But as you say, the majority of people who greeted him were seemingly supportive. And I guess what that says is that there's mixed reaction to all this in Iran. Is that a good thing? I mean, what does mixed reaction actually symbolize in a country like Iran?
Well, I think it's a little bit too early to tell, but I think mixed reaction is a sign of greater truth that Iran is a very diverse country in terms of people's points of view on international relations and their country's place in the world. But I think by and large, most Iranians see that relations with the U.S. will probably lead to better economic prospects for their country, especially if it results in the lifting of economic sanctions.
The other thing that was interesting was Rouhani talking today about the possibility of resuming flights between the U.S. and Iran. Last week, Rouhani said a deal on nukes could be struck in 3 to 6 months. Would you say these signs of his hopefulness are also the signs of Iranians' hopefulness?
I think so. And I think that there's, you know, John Kerry and President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif have all said that they think that they can get a nuclear deal within 3 to 6 months. I think that might be a bit optimistic, but we haven't heard that kind of language coming from Tehran or Washington for a very long time.
You fly occasionally to the U.S., Jason. How do you feel about a new way to get back to the United States? I mean, how much time would that actually shave off your flight?
Lots. I think that, you know, I'm from the West Coast, and to get from Tehran to San Francisco in the best circumstances takes me about 22 hours. And a direct flight from Tehran to San Francisco would be a long flight, but it would be a 14-hour direct shot, and I'm all for it. I'm ready to cut out Istanbul and Dubai from my flight paths.
I'll bet. Jason Rezaian, Tehran correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco. Have a great day.
So that's the view from Iran. Several nations in the Middle East are worried about where future talks between the U.S. and Iran may lead. Israel, for one, isn't happy about them. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was at the White House today, urging President Obama to stick to a tough line when it comes to dealing with Tehran. Others in the region are just as concerned. Saudi Arabia has long seen Iran as an enemy, and the two nations are competing for power across the Middle East in a kind of mini Cold War. To help us get a handle on all this, I'm joined by Gregory Goss. He's a professor of political science at the University of Vermont. So, Gregory, remind us briefly why Iran and Saudi Arabia see each other as enemies. And is it as simple as a Sunni-Shia divide? I mean, Sunnis in Saudi Arabia, Shias in Iran?
I think that's part of it, but I think we tend to overestimate that. I do think that this is a balance of power conflict between two states that are looking to be the main actor in their part of the world. Now, the fight is between them is played out in the domestic politics of states that have weak governments or that have had domestic upheavals, like Iraq, like Syria, like Lebanon, like Yemen, like Bahrain. And in these weak states, the Sunnis tend to look to Saudi Arabia for support and the Shia tend to look to Iran. And so it's from within these kinds of very divided and conflictual domestic political societies that we get, I think, the sectarianism. But I think at the top levels in both Iran and Saudi Arabia, I think they see it more as a balance of power fight.
So tell us what the reaction has been in Saudi Arabia to, you know, this little but big thing last week, a conversation between the U.S. president and President Rouhani of Iran. How did Saudis react?
Well, the telephone call between President Rouhani and President Obama has been very much in the news in the Gulf states, has been seen by some commentators as the beginning of a huge geopolitical shift. I think that this is an exaggeration. But I think that the government of Saudi Arabia and of the smaller Gulf states, those governments worry that the United States will not be a reliable ally, that it will, quote unquote, sell out their interests in a deal with Iran. I think that this is an exaggerated view, but I think that there's a fear that the U.S. will go further than it actually will in accommodating the Iranians.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is how Washington and the Saudis see Syria. I mean, Washington first came up with this threat of imminent military action on Syria's use of chemical weapons, then a UN Security Council resolution to destroy those weapons last Friday. How has Saudi Arabia seen all of this?
I think that the general reaction among the chattering class in Saudi Arabia has been real disappointment that the president backed away from the threat of military force. There's a lot of strong public opinion support in Saudi Arabia for the rebels in Syria, a lot of sympathy for what they've gone through. And there was a sense that now finally the United States was going to do something about it. And so I think that this just plays into the perception of some people in the Gulf that President Obama is somewhat weak, somewhat naive. I'm not sure that that's shared at the very top levels of government, but I'm sure that there's something of that disappointment. Particularly given the fact that the Saudis were out front publicly saying before the event that they would support an attack. So I think they probably felt that the rug got pulled out from under them.
Gregory Goss, professor of political science at the University of Vermont. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
And there is a sense of expectation that the Kenyan is going to do it. Could this be the new man? Wilson Kipsang, we're past 2 hours 3. And he's going to do it in the end.
And Kenyan runner Wilson Kipsang did do it in the end. He set a marathon world record yesterday in Berlin, completing the 26.2-mile course in 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 23 seconds. But how long will this record hold? Michael Joyner is a physician at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota who studies the physical limits of the human body. He says Berlin's flat course, the cool weather, and a group of pace setters had a lot to do with the world record, and so did the place Kipsang calls home.
Most of the great runners today are East Africans. They grow up at high altitude. They're physically active literally from day one. You hear stories about people running 2 or 3 miles to school every day, and this running, of course, is done at 8 or 9,000 feet. So those are a couple things they have going for them. Next, they're small. The average size of these guys is 5'6", 5'7", 5'8", and they weigh about 120 or 30 pounds. And they also have great running economy or running efficiency. So they're able to generate an awful lot of speed for not very much oxygen.
So are you saying that if you're not from East Africa and you don't have the ideal running conditions on the day of, you're not going to do well?
Well, you certainly need the ideal conditions. And I think the East African thing may have been overplayed a bit. They've certainly been dominant recently, but there are histories of different cultural or ethnic groups dominating in the past. For example, the Finns held every world record in the 10,000 meter from 1912 to the middle 1940s. The Eastern Europeans were dominant in the later 40s and throughout the 50s. And then in the late 50s and early 60s, the Australians and New Zealanders were dominant. So some of it is cultural as well, and people need to realize that the per capita income in places like Kenya and Ethiopia is literally hundreds of dollars per year. So going out and having a big payday at one of these marathons is really something for these guys. So they have tremendous motivation, as well as this collection of cultural, perhaps physiological, and also environmental conditions that help them run fast.
What about other factors like the Olympics? Do people perform less well at the Olympics? I guess what I'm driving at here is, you know, with races like the Berlin Marathon, where there's a purse, a prize money at the end, does that make a difference?
Sure. We saw this in 2012, where many of the favorites in the race in the Olympic marathon, once they saw they weren't going to compete for a medal or weren't in contention for a medal, stopped somewhere at the 15 or 20 mile mark because they could live to fight another day during one of the big fall marathons and perhaps have a big payday. And again, that's one of the things that's driving some of these world records or the improvement in world records in the marathon over the last 5-10 years is this emergence of big prize money races. And again, if the per capita income in your home country is $500 or $1,000 a year, that's a very, very big payday, and it goes a long, long way.
So we've reached this milestone, 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 23 seconds. There's now a lot of talk about beating the 2-hour mark, 2 hours flat. How likely is a sub-2-hour marathon? When does that happen?
If you do a number of kind of simple back-of-the-envelope calculations and use some pace converters and other things, the world record for the marathon should be in the 202 range. And so what I expect to happen is over the next 3 or 4 years, either through one big jump or continuous kind of 15, 20 second bites, I think the record will get to about 202.30 or maybe 202.15. And then the fun will start. the fun will really start, because what people need to recognize is, and people who've run fast understand this, is that 2 or 3 minutes at some level isn't very much time. At another level, it's a lifetime. A little bit like what Nelson Mandela said about being in prison, you know, the days seemed like years and the years seemed like days. So sometimes a minute or two in a marathon or a 10K can be the longest minute or two you'll ever experience.
Michael Joyner, physiologist at the Mayo Clinic. He studies the mechanics of running. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you, Marco.
We have a really cool graphic charting the progress in marathon world records over the past decade. And let me just say, a lot of runners seem to like Berlin. You can see the graph over at our new online home, PRI.org. Still ahead on the world, no bicycles allowed. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You may have noticed something missing from your garden or backyard this year. Monarch butterflies. Their populations have plummeted to historic lows across North America. Now, several factors are involved in that decline, and to help us understand what's happening, reporter Dave Sherwood takes us from New England to Mexico and back again.
Swan Island on Maine's Kennebec River is the perfect summer home for the monarch butterfly.
These fields should be full of flying monarchs.
Bob Gobiel is a volunteer for the Maine Butterfly Survey. He and his wife Rosemary are traipsing through fields of yellow and purple wildflowers past an old clapboard farmhouse. Bald eagles soar overhead.
Because of the number of milkweed plants on the island, literally acres, it's almost perfect for butterflies.
If you're looking for monarchs, Gobiel says, milkweed is the key. With its white sap, cottony seeds, and big green leaves, it's the one plant that one of the continent's most familiar butterflies can't live without. But this year, even in this forest of milkweed, no monarchs.
The monarch is so bright, it's large, and it's usually in abundance, so people just see it, and oh, there goes a monarch. But to have that absence is really strange.
The reports are the same all across the country. Few or no monarchs in places where they should be common. A couple of hundred miles south, school kids use magic markers to color paper monarchs at the Boston Nature Center, an oasis of meadows and forest in the heart of the city.
That's great. Did you write your name on it?
But here, too, the real thing is missing. Karen First is a member of the Monarch Teacher Network, a group that uses butterflies to teach kids about nature.
It's been very, very quiet in the butterfly garden here at the Boston Nature Center. And it's that silence that really began to alarm me.
It's an alarm that's been ringing all across the monarch's range.
This is a migration phenomenon.
Omar Vidal is director of the World Wildlife Fund in Mexico.
So if there is mortality or low numbers in the U.S. and Canada, then we have small numbers in Mexico.
Mexico is the first leg of an epic migration that takes most of North America's monarchs from remote mountaintops south of the border to the U.S. and Canada and back. Think of it like a relay race. The first generation begins its journey in Mexico every spring, and over the next year, three generations or more head north, reproducing, dying, and passing the baton to the next, ultimately ending up in places like Boston and Maine. Then that final generation flies all the way south, back to their ancestral forests, sometimes to the very same trees where their great-grandparents had spent the winter the year before. For years, it was that key part of the monarch's habitat that was under attack from illegal logging.
We receive a lot of criticism from the U.S. that Mexico was not doing enough, and that they were right.
Omar Vidal says Mexico has begun to take steps to protect its remaining monarch habitat. But now there are new threats to the north.
All in all, the last two breeding seasons have been just a disaster for monarchs, and this is going to be the lowest overwintering population ever.
That's Chip Taylor, an insect ecologist at the University of Kansas and founder of the group Monarch Watch. Even as conditions have improved in Mexico, Taylor says extreme weather in the U.S. and Canada over the past 2 years has ravaged monarch populations here. Last year, fewer monarchs returned to Mexico than ever before, part of a steady downward trend over two decades. In the past, he says, a bout of bad weather wasn't enough to send populations spiraling.
But of course, that combines with a decline in the resource, a decline in the habitat that supports monarch butterflies.
And that brings us back to milkweed. Not long ago, Taylor says, the vast corn and soybean fields of the U.S. Midwest supported enough milkweed to ensure plenty of monarch habitat. The turning point, he says, was the year 2000, when farmers began using genetically modified crops that resist the herbicide glyphosate, or Roundup. And of course, the use of more herbicide-resistant seeds meant the use of more herbicide.
After 2000, when we saw the adoption of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans begin to skyrocket, then we began to see the monarchs decline. And they declined with the loss of milkweeds in those corn and soybean fields.
To be clear, the problem isn't the GMO crops themselves. Taylor says it's the herbicide that goes with them, which is only doing what it was designed to do, kill weeds like milkweed. Some scientists have criticized the research linking Roundup to a decline in monarchs. Monsanto, the company that makes the herbicide, hasn't said much at all. But Taylor and others say the result of the huge increase in Roundup has been devastating for monarchs. And then the bad weather of the last 2 years seemed to have been the last straw for many more. Taylor says monarchs are a very resilient species, and they aren't likely to disappear altogether. But he worries that if their habitat continues to dwindle, their grand continental migration could go with it, which raises a basic question for him.
Does the average person miss a monarch if it's not there? Probably not. I'm worried about that because I don't see that we really connect very well with nature anymore.
Put your hands kind of together. Oh, there it goes.
Bye-bye.
Back in Boston, teacher Karen First releases a tagged monarch before an excited crowd of 4- and 5-year-olds, many of whom have never seen one. She's doing her best to make sure these kids know about monarchs, even if no wild ones actually show up.
I'm more worried that the story is going to disappear. They just have this amazing story, and it is a perfect way to get kids to care. And I really believe that as kids grow up, that they're going to work to save the things that they care about.
Adios, mariposa, adios, cha-cha-cha.
And that just means goodbye, my friend butterfly.
For The World, I'm Dave Sherwood, Boston, Massachusetts.
Dave did spot a few monarchs while reporting that story. You can check out his pics at PRI.org. Bicycle sharing programs are pretty popular around the globe. They seem to be everywhere. Amsterdam, New York, Paris, Copenhagen, Montreal, here in Boston. But the city we want you to name is going in the opposite direction. This major city in India has banned bicycles from major roads. Authorities there say the bikes slow down motorized traffic, contributing to gridlock. But many of those bikes are used for commerce, and the ban could have unintended consequences.
You're talking about people who deliver milk, who deliver newspapers on cycles, deliver goods. So it's like the entire city is going to come to a standstill.
So which city in India is it? We'll hear how cyclists there are trying to fight the ban when we return with the answer to our GeoQuiz later in the program. You're listening to The World on PRI and at PRI.org. This is Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, our former Beijing correspondent sure doesn't miss the battle with air pollution there.
Staying inside with the windows closed and the air filter on, you know, taking shallow breaths. And at that point, I think a lot of people started thinking, this is a fantastic place. It's an extraordinary experience being here, but at what cost to my health?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Mary Kay Magstad joins me in the studio now. You know her, or her voice anyway. For the past decade, Mary Kay has been our East Asia correspondent reporting for The World from her home base in Beijing. She's been our expert link to China and its many transformations and the seemingly infinite ways that China affects our lives here in the U.S. But her expertise also took her far from Chinese borders to report award-winning stories from places like Burma, Bhutan, and Indonesia. Well, 3 weeks ago, Mary Kay left Beijing to move back here to the States. And from time to time, she'll be joining us to talk about the role of China in our lives. Right, Mary Kay?
Absolutely. And as you say, China affects our lives in myriad ways. So it'll be interesting for me to look from the perspective of being an American in America, looking at how China impacts American lives, and then occasionally going back and looking again at how everything here looks from the Chinese perspective.
So I know your time in China, it seems like a lifetime there, now just 3 weeks back here, so maybe it's a little tough to compare. But just in the time that you've been back here in the States, what have you noticed about, you know, China's presence in our lives here in the U.S.?
Well, I'm living in San Francisco, and particularly in a neighborhood of San Francisco where I can walk for several blocks and hear Mandarin and Cantonese for that whole stretch. A very multicultural community. But also, you go into any shop, and as we all know, and many things are made in China, the Bay Bridge in San Francisco was built by Chinese engineers. There are a lot of different ways in which Chinese manufacturing, Chinese immigration, and Chinese culture affects certainly San Francisco itself, but also the United States as a whole.
It's always hard to get the news from China when you're in China. How are you getting your news about China now that you're back here? Are you like actually getting news walking through those neighborhoods in San Francisco that you wouldn't have gotten in Beijing, you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, I always try to chat with people no matter where I am, and I have gravitated toward places that speak Chinese and where I can connect with people who, you know, have something in common from, you know, where I came from in Beijing. And I have found a few places like that. I'm continuing. I mean, you know, but the internet is a wonderful thing, right? So I can continue to check out some of the same sources that I was using when I was in China, blogs about China, newspapers within China and Hong Kong, and listservs that I've been on for many years about China.
10 years is such a long time. What do you miss?
Well, actually, I was in Asia for almost 25 years.
25 years is a long time. What
yeah.
do you miss?
The buzz. You know, actually, I think any place seems quiet compared to the sorts of places I've lived in Asia, Beijing, Hong Kong, Bangkok. These are extraordinarily vibrant cities that have been going through a historic shift. And, you know, where people who were used to a certain way of life are very rapidly adopting a different way of life. And in Beijing in particular, from 1 week to the next or 1 month to the next, neighborhoods would disappear. New buildings would come up. Suddenly, I would notice people would be wearing completely new sorts of ensembles in my neighborhood, which was a fairly trendy neighborhood. It was just really interesting. It was always interesting every day. And I'm sure my new neighborhood will prove interesting as well. But I think it takes a little bit more awareness and digging and just, you know, recognizing more subtle changes as you go along. In Beijing, it's like a fire hose.
You know, and just the sheer scale of the population. I recently saw a map where there was a circle placed over Southeast Asia. So kind of over China, it covers a bit of India, Myanmar, Thailand, Vietnam. And it said there are more people inside the circle than outside the circle in the entire world. So that gave me a sense. Are you just seeing that as well? Just fewer people in a kind of appreciative way?
Well, sure. I mean, Beijing's a city of 22 million people.
That's amazing.
And, you know, San Francisco, I think the greater metropolitan area is, what, somewhere between 3 and 5 million,
yeah.
Which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at. But it does feel, you know, I look around and someone comments about how much traffic there is. I'm like, what? Yeah, I mean, we're still moving. That's something. Of course, it's great to be in a place where you can actually breathe. So that's
I was just going to say, when you were in Beijing and we'd speak, you often had to start early in the conversation clearing your throat. That's how bad the air was. So how's the air compare here in the U.S.?
Oh, it's so much better. The air pollution in Beijing was 40 times the maximum that the World Health Organization says human beings should expose themselves to, that maximum level of pollution. It was just extraordinarily bad. I was, you know, staying inside with the windows closed and the air filter on, you know, taking shallow breaths.
Breaking Bad ended last night. I gather it's huge in China. Do you know why?
Well, there are a lot of viewers who just find it a fascinating story, but there are some who are a little bemused by the premise. You know, they're saying, okay, so this guy, he's a school teacher, right? But he's got a house, he's got a pool, so you're telling me he has to, you know, kind of work these weird jobs and cook drugs to make money? I don't get it. You know, in China, you've got people who are school teachers who are barely making it. You get people who are making even better money who still can't afford to buy an apartment. You know, for the average Beijinger now, middle-class Beijinger, it takes 25 years' income to buy a two-bedroom apartment. It's a huge problem, and it's one that the government's going to have to be grappling with in the months and years to come.
All right. Before you go, Mary Kay, since you're freshly back in this country, I've got to just check your pop culture IQ real quick. So three questions. Let's see if you can field any of these. What's twerking?
Twerking is dancing in a very sexually suggestive way,
okay.
And Miley Cyrus was doing it.
Very good. Describe the ingredients of a little-known dish in China called crab rangoon.
No idea.
Okay, see, it doesn't exist there, people. It's cream cheese and crab, either real or artificial. And finally, not that
you'll... Yeah, the cuisine is so different in China than it is here, what you call Chinese cuisine.
Crazy, isn't it? Not that you'll ever need it, but finally, what is the cost of a first-class postage stamp these days?
45 cents?
Oh, very close. It was 46 cents. We'll give you half a point. All right, Mary Kay, we'll end it there. We look forward to hearing more from you. We'll check in regularly and get your perspective of China from an American point of view. And you'll also be blogging for us, and we'll post a link to your latest at PRI.org. Great to have you here. Great to have you in the studio, Mary Kay. Thanks.
Thanks, Marco. Always a pleasure.
So shifting gears now, Pope Francis today announced that two of his predecessors, John XXIII and John Paul II, will be canonized next April. The news about John Paul is, of course, huge news in his native Poland, a devoutly Catholic nation where memories of the late pontiff are still used to rally the faithful. But Poland is also a changing nation, as we hear in this report from Kavita Pillay.
In 2010, the largest Jesus statue in the world was erected in this windswept cabbage field opposite a supermarket in western Poland. The 108-foot-high Christ the King statue is a clear testament to Polish piety, and it symbolically guards this oft-conquered country from its latest intruder, secularism. It might seem that setting up a bulwark against secularism is a bit premature. Surveys of religious attitudes in Poland show that just a small percentage of Poles have been moving away from the church since Pope John Paul II's death in 2005. But the survey suggests that the numbers are growing.
Maybe I'm not that much conservative as my parents are.
Ula Sawicka and her boyfriend Piotrek are both 24 years old, born just as Poland was emerging from 4 decades of communist rule. In between Ula's shifts as a hostess at a trendy bar in Warsaw's Old Town, the two eagerly discussed their views on religion and politics in Poland.
So there's like, for example, abortion or in vitro, something which is a really hot topic in Poland. So for me, it's like the people choice. And maybe it's not right with the Catholic thinking, yeah? But I'm a more modern Catholic person.
I don't think that you would find an older person in Poland who's not going to church. But I think that younger generation is rather like me. I'm not going to church. I don't believe in God. I consider myself an atheist.
The young generation especially would like to be free of religion.
Janusz Palikot heads up the party that bears his name. 2 years ago, the Palikot Party became the country's only explicitly secular political faction. Its platform includes such controversial measures as legalizing abortion and marijuana, ending religious education in public schools, and cutting off state funding for the Catholic Church. Currently, the Palikot Party boasts the world's only transgender parliamentarian.
I think in the next 10 years, the situation in Poland will be absolutely as in Spain or Italy. There was also very Catholic countries 20, 25 years ago, and the same will be in Poland, I'm hope. And the future is with me.
But some of Palikot's critics warn that killing Catholicism may lead to unintended and unpleasant consequences.
Europa się bardzo dynamicznie zmienia i że zmiany demograficzne prowadzą do tego, że...
Tomasz Terlikowski is the editor of a right-wing quarterly magazine called Fronda, meaning slingshot. Like many conservative Poles, Terlikowski sees Catholicism as the essence of Poland. And he'd like to see religion bolstered in society.
Demograficznych chrześcijaństwo musi pozostać istotnym elementem tożsamości Europy.
Terlikowski says, "We are convinced that if Europe is to remain Europe, then Christianity has to be a very important cultural element in its cultural life. And those currently promoting secularism in Poland will soon face what he calls a much less conciliatory and much more confrontational force, Islam."
I am more afraid of Mr. Terlikowski than about Muslims.
Jacek Dobrowolski is a philosophy professor at Warsaw University.
I would much more prefer Muslims to come here and to admix something to our culture. And actually, we need new people coming here because our society is aging, so we need immigrants. Let them be Muslims as well. Why not?
Dobrowolski says that many Poles still view Catholicism as a form of patriotism, with the cross and statues of Jesus often standing in for the Polish flag. In lieu of continually looking to the church for national symbols, Dobrowolski hopes that a new generation of Poles will embrace more secular ones, like the flag of the European Union. But ironically, those 12 stars on the EU flag? Turns out that the man who came up with the design was inspired by artwork featuring the Virgin Mary with a halo of 12 golden stars. For the World, I'm Kavita Pillay.
We have more on Poland's debate over secularism, including a video featuring the head of the country's first secular political party. That's at PRI.org. So I believe everyone has a novel in them just waiting to get written. But let's face it, it's not easy to jumpstart a writing career anywhere. But in Peru, where books are expensive and published in very small numbers, it's especially tough. But now there's Lucha Libro. It's based on Mexico's Lucha Libre, where wrestlers put on masks and pseudonyms to duke it out in a ring. Here, the contestants put masks and use fake names too, but they take to the ring to write short stories on the clock and in front of a live crowd. Crazy, right? Reporter Annie Murphy has a story.
On a chilly Monday night, a bar called La Noche is packed. Usually people come to see live bands, but tonight they're here for Lucha Libro, a form of literary wrestling, where new writers are given three random words, a laptop hooked up to a gigantic screen, and 5 minutes to write a short story. At the end of a match, the losing writer has to take off their mask. The winner goes on to the next round a week later, and the grand prize? It's a book contract. The crowd is youngish, people in their 20s and 30s, a lot of big glasses and skinny jeans. An announcer in a striped referee shirt takes the stage.
Señoras y señores, muy buenas noches, ¿cómo están?
The first contestant is a guy who goes by the name Chicken Wilson. He's tall and goofy, but when he sees the three words projected on the screen behind him, he gets serious. He's got monkey, plane ticket, and dictionary to work with.
Uno. Dos. Tres. Tiempo.
The announcer counts to three and the clock starts. No one is talking. But just a paragraph in, Chicken Wilson freezes. The seconds are ticking by, so the crowd starts cheering him on. And he rallies, dashing off a short story about monkeys living in the city and an American girl on vacation in Peru. This event is more than just a bunch of young writers fooling around in wrestling masks, says Dante Trujillo. He runs the Solar Editorial House, which will publish the winning entry. He says that even though Peru's economy is doing well right now, Peru is still feeling the impact of some hard decades. There was the military government in the 70s, the civil war in the 80s, and then the collapse of the economy.
Entonces las perspectivas para un autor...
And so for young authors just beginning their careers, the best advice you can give them is to get out of Peru.
Backstage, Chicken Wilson explains that his pseudonym is a family nickname. But other contestants say that there's more to their stage names. One young woman with a pale blonde braid falling out the back of her black wrestler's mask calls herself L, like the letter.
When I write, I often write lyrical pieces, poems, and I usually sign them with that one letter. L also stands for loser to me, and this concept of the underdog, of a person that nobody thinks can win, I'm really into that.
Actually, it's Chicken Wilson who ends up losing his match while L advances. Whoever wins the final round in a few weeks will have 6 months to finish their book. It'll be released at the Lima Book Fair, where the writer will take off the mask and reveal his or her real identity for the first time. Writer Jonathan Vasquez is one of the founders of Lucha Libro. He says the chance to win that coveted publishing contract is important, but not all there is to it. He says it's also about changing the idea that literature is boring. According to him, this turns it into an event, because it's not just about the opportunity for a young person to become a writer, he says. It's also about having a place for young people to hang out and to read. For The World, I'm Annie Murphy in Lima.
And in this corner, we have photos of a masked Chicken Wilson in the writer's ring. You can see him at PRI.org. And you're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Back to that city now we asked you about in our geo quiz, the one that's banning bicycles in an effort to combat traffic gridlock. That city is Kolkata in India. Ekta Kothari is a cyclist there, and she's helping to challenge the ban on bikes, or cycles, as they're called in India.
So they have banned cycles and non-motorized transport from 174 thoroughfares. This is like a blanket ban across Kolkata. This is in the eastern part of India. And this is from 7 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock in the night. So they expect people to sort of ride their bikes from 11 p.m. in the night to 6 in the morning, which is absolutely insane.
Does that mean that dedicated cyclists can still bike, but they'll have to figure out shortcuts through alleyways?
So there are lots of small alleys and by lanes, but they're not connected to each other. So eventually you would have to cut across a major road, and that's where you would be caught by the cops. And cycling not just means recreation, and it not just means that, you know, I can't go to my office tomorrow. But for a big chunk of people, it is their livelihood. You're talking about people who deliver milk, who deliver newspapers on cycles. You have the entire city delivering goods on non-motorized transport like cycle vans, hand carts. So it's like the entire city is going to come to a standstill if the ban actually takes effect.
And when is it supposed to take effect?
So what's happening now is that if you're caught by the cops, which is like very often, then you have to pay a fine, which is very arbitrary. And you don't get a receipt saying that you have paid a 100 rupee fine or a 300 rupee fine. And you would have to pay that to get your bicycle or your van released and then go on for your work. That receipt is valid for a day. So again, tomorrow you may be caught.
What's this going to do to commerce and the economy of Calcutta?
So the interesting part is that though they have banned, they haven't really banned these people. So these people still ply on the streets like before. Now it's just that they have to pay between 100 to 300 rupees every time they're caught by the police. So what they say now is they feel like thieves. It's almost like as soon as they see a cop, they get off their cycle, they start walking with their cycles. They try to sort of take another route or something, and they don't feel good about it.
I got to say, Ekta, from the way you describe it, it sounds like a ban on bicycles in Kolkata could be calamitous for the city.
It's absolutely crazy. So we've all gotten together to start a movement in Kolkata. We call this the Chakra Satyagraha. Chakra stands for wheel, or the symbol of wheel in the Indian flag. And Satyagraha is, of course, the non-violent protest that Mahatma Gandhi undertook to get freedom for the country. We're doing a really large event on the 2nd of October. We're expecting about 7 to 10,000 people who'll get together, sit on a major crossing in the city. What we are hoping is that the government will see some sense, especially when they see tens of thousands of people on the street. And it's not just going to impact them, but the entire city, because the entire city is connected and dependent on these people. If tomorrow they actually stop, there will be no milk, there will be no newspapers in almost all the houses of Kolkata. So we cannot have them lifted from the streets without giving them an alternative.
Ekta Kothari in Kolkata, India, which is the answer to our GeoQuiz today. Ekta, thank you, and the best of luck on your two wheels.
It was lovely speaking with you.
Finally today, we're going to hear from one of the artists who took part in the recent Americana Music Festival in Nashville. I'm talking about British musician Billy Bragg. Now, it might seem funny to talk to a Brit about Americana, but as Bragg himself told me, it actually makes perfect sense.
If Americana is music inspired by American roots music, then I think we Brits have a sort of like first adapters of Americana, in the sense that in the late 1950s, there was a craze of music in the UK called skiffle. A guy named Lonnie Donegan was having hits in the charts in the UK with songs that were originally taken from the repertoire of artists such as Lead Belly, Woody Guthrie, the American folk tradition, and took off like lightning among kids as young as 13, 14, and 15. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Oh boy, you're gonna die. That was the age of Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and George Harrison when they first started playing guitar, and they all played skiffle. And what was special about this music was that there was nothing else like it in the British charts at the time. It was almost underground.
Skiffle didn't really exist in the US, right? So how did the Brits hear what they were hearing from the US and kind of reinvented as skiffle?
There was a guy called Ken Collier who was obsessed with the New Orleans jazz played in the first decades of the 20th century by people like Bunk Johnson and Kid Ory. And In post-war Britain, he wanted to go to New Orleans and find these guys. He realized some of these guys were still playing on Bourbon Street. The only way he could think to get there was to join the Merchant Navy. But eventually he ended up in Mobile, Alabama, which is close to New Orleans, and he jumped ship, left the ship, where he actually met some of Bunk Johnson's band, and he sat in with them and he played with them. He wanted to know where this music came from, and they kind of sent him out to these old guys who were out in the bayou who were playing what we would refer to now as blues, a little bit of country, a lot of folk songs, except at the time it hadn't been genred.
Right. Well, let's take a pause and listen to Ken Collier with this new sound. This is a track from 1956. This is Ken Collier playing the song Downbound Train.
A stranger lying on a barroom floor has drank so much he could drink no more. And so he fell asleep with a troubled brain. To dream that he rode on a downbound train.
This is 1956. We're talking kind of the vintage of Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley and the Comets. Why do you think this American roots music took off with Brits in Britain, but not in the US?
Well, you've got to remember, in post-war Britain, it was pretty rough. Sweets were rationed. Clothing was rationed. Post-war austerity, most of those kids we were talking about, Lennon, McCartney, had only known the war or the post-war period all their lives. They were most of them born in the early 40s. So anything coming from America was bright, shiny, new, represented an aspiration for a better life.
Don't you think, Billy Bragg, that all music comes from somewhere else? I mean, I think of flamenco, we think Spain, but it really came from Rajasthan. You say mambo, we all think Cuba, but it really came from Congo.
I mean, particularly for a country like Britain, which has such a huge maritime history, our culture has always been porous, and our great skill has been taking other people's culture and selling it back to them. Look at the Beatles going back and playing, you know, Tamla Motown to teenagers in the United States of America. And I think music has to be like that. It has to be capable of breaking down barriers and bringing people together, and I think that's the power of music.
Billy Bragg's latest album is Tooth and Nail. He's currently touring around the U.S. playing, among other things, his own take on Americana. Billy Bragg, thank you so much.
Great to speak to you.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yeah, that'll be the day when you make me cry. I say you're gonna leave. You don't like us. That'll be the day when I die.
Yep, that's John Lennon and his skiffle group, the Quarrymen, pre-Beatles, covering Buddy Holly. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We're online round the clock at PRI.org, and we're back here on the radio tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.